Hello, welcome to the Luceco full year results presentation and conference call. Throughout the call, all participants will be in listen-only mode, and afterwards there'll be a question and answer session for analysts. Just to remind you, the conference call is being recorded. I'm pleased to present John Hornby, CEO, and Matt Webb, CFO. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Tamsin. Good morning, everybody. This is John Hornby, CEO of Luceco. I hope you all had a copy of the presentation that was sent this morning. I think we're going to run you through that, and then at the end of the call, we will take any questions. So on page three, you can see the composition of the group in terms of the four product areas: wiring accessories, LED lighting, portable power, ROS. And you can see that overall percentages really haven't changed much from 2018, and they all grew by about the same amount. Turning over the page, slide four, I will just run you through the highlights of our results for last year. As I said, the revenue grew by 5%. The operating profit, however, more than doubled as a result of significantly higher margins. You will recall that at the beginning of 2018, we embarked upon a project to improve the group margin, which at the end of 17 had turned out to be significantly lower than we had otherwise realized. So a combination of working with the factories, particularly with our own factory, re-engineering products, working on the mix and adjusting the market pricing, resulted in a doubling of the operating margin from 2018 into 2019. The other major improvement was in the cash conversion. We converted more than 100% of the revenue growth into operating profit. And as a result, we generated free cash flow of almost 19 million last year against only 8 million in the previous year, as a result of which closing net debt finished just over 1x EBITDA, again halved from the position at the end of the previous year. We managed to, as I say, continue the growth of the business, but we also invested in improving the customer service, and in particular to improve the operations of our Chinese entity to improve the margin and improve our working capital. A quick update on the virus. I mean, Matt will go into the situation in greater detail later. We initially experienced this at the end of January, when our factories closed down and they didn't open again until the middle of February. However, by the end of March, the factories were up and running at about 100% of their previous capacity, but we quickly realized that we were actually making too much stock, because as the virus obviously spread towards the west, it was going to have a major impact on the market demand. So we have since taken many actions, which, as I say, Matt will run you through, but one of which has been to halve the amount of workforce at the factory in China, and the revenue is currently running at about half of the normal level. At the start of the lockdown, at the beginning of April, it was running at about 30%. And as the month of April has some progressed, it has improved week on week. At this sort of 50% of normal revenue, we will be roughly break even at the EBITDA level with a monthly cash outflow of about £500,000. But because we have a huge amount of headroom in our banking facilities, we don't consider that we will have any material problems throughout this lockdown period. Matt will speak more about the financing later. So with that, I'd like to hand over to Matt, who will go through the full year results for last year.
Great, thank you, John, and good morning, everyone. So without further ado, slide six, income statement. Starting with the revenue line, we finished with revenue of 172 million, which was bang in line with our January trading update. That meant that we grew the revenue by 5% year over year. The overwhelming majority of that came in the form of like-for-like growth. The standout performance, I think, in the P&L was gross margin. So if you recall, for the first half, gross margin stood at 35%. The fact that we got to 36.2% for the full year meant that our second half was 37.4%, which is a record for the group. I'll explain this in more detail in a minute, but a significant proportion of that, as John has referenced, came from within the company, so from our work rather than simply charging customers more for our products, and that's very pleasing to see. To finish the picture on operating profit, overheads were also well controlled. So overall growth pretty much in line with revenue, not something that the group has necessarily achieved in the past. And I would say that we achieved that despite some increases from what I would call, you know, non-discretionary items, so things that we couldn't do much about. And I'll explain that in more detail in a minute. So if you put that all together, pretty decent revenue growth, excellent gross margins, tight control of overheads, meant that we doubled our operating profit and doubled our operating margin, as John has said. So very good to see that. The work on the P&L didn't quite finish there, so we also took the time to reduce the tax rate as well. So in 2018, it was 27%. This year, 2019, was 23.4%. Some of that came from just restoring the profitability of our UK business and therefore being taxed more at 19% in the UK rather than at higher rates overseas. But we also spent some time simplifying the UK corporate structure to basically free up some losses that were previously trapped. So overall, we're pretty pleased with the P&L for 2019. If you then flip on the page to the revenue bridge, as I said, the overall growth of 5%, most of it came from like for like, so specifically 3.9%. To put that in context, the first half like for like growth was just over 8%. So therefore, you know, the fact that we ended up with 4% for the year does mean that we didn't see a huge amount of like for like growth in the second half. We did say that would happen. And it came from the fact that, as we predicted, the comparatives definitely did get tougher, particularly in our UK retail business. And of course, you can't overlook the macro uncertainty in our core UK market as well. So that's the like-for-like story. Yes, of course, we did close the US operations in 2018, so we saw the full year effect of that. It held back the revenue slightly, but you know, absolutely improved the profit. Now, this was a loss-making business. It probably lost about £2 million a year at the point of closure. And we had a bit of an FX tailwind. So if you recall, roughly half of our revenue is denominated in dollars because we sell on an FOB basis. The dollar strengthened by 4%, so therefore, you know, that's a 2% gain in terms of overall revenue. Okay, flipping on to slide eight, revenue by geography. just to sort of put it in context, we've shown you the different speeds of revenue growth around the group. In the top half of the, on the graphs, you've got the UK business. Bottom half is then overseas. Top left is obviously UK retail. This is roughly 50% of group revenue. Overall, a good result. The growth was quite front-end loaded. We were comparing ourselves against a relatively depressed 2018 number at that point, because in 2018, if you recall, our customers were destocking. And it was before we put through quite a big price increase across the group, actually, particularly in the second half of 2018. So that was an easier comparative. It was, we knew that growth would slow down in the second half, and so it did. Part of the slowdown was caused by the fact that there were a couple of customers, one big customer in particular, that was managing their inventory in advance of their year end. I can't tell you who it was, but it's a customer that's got a new CEO who obviously didn't much like the inventory balance. So it meant fewer orders for us. By the time we got into 2020, that situation had normalized until the virus came along. Top right, you'll see UK Professional. So this is sale of Project LED, as well as sales of products to professional distributors. I described that growth as pretty hesitant all year, particularly on the Project LED side. We saw lots of interest from customers, lots of theoretical projects, but not a lot of customers wanting to turn those into orders. And we particularly saw that around the two successive Brexit extensions, and as well as the general election, which is understandable. So very much influenced by the macro backdrop in the UK. The good news is that what we lacked in revenue growth, we more than made up for in terms of gross profit improvement in that category. On the bottom half of that page, Europe had a really strong year. So overall growth of 13.2%. And I would call out Spain, who had 6% growth, Ireland and Germany, who both had 20% growth year over year. So these are good, successful overseas businesses that are gaining critical mass for us. The only slight drawback was France, where it's proven to be a fairly challenging market for us, and we have since discovered that we probably had the wrong management team. So we've taken steps in the second half to move responsibility for France underneath what we think is a very strong Spanish management team. So we're hopeful that will, it's lowered the cost base, it's improved the chances of moving to break even, and we feel we've got the right management oversight in place now. Finishing the picture, rest of world, it did decline. I would say the Middle East, which makes up roughly half of this total, actually had a really strong year. So that's a mature business of scale that we have in Dubai. They did well. We did less well in Asia and Mexico in particular. Mexico, that was definitely a macro effect. So as a result of a new socialist government that was installed there. The good news in the rest of the world is, a bit like UK Professional, we may have lacked revenue growth, but the profits actually, if anything, were held flat year over year. Okay, moving on to slide 9. I'm showing you a sort of a 1 year bridge of gross margin here. I sort of regret not having showed you the 2 year bridge, because it would have emphasized what we've achieved here. So just to give you the numbers, in the first half of 2018, which was our sort of trough margins as a group, the margins at that point were down at 27.3%. In the second half of 2019, they were at 37.4%. So over 1,000 basis points of gross margin improvement, which is a real achievement for the group. And John has mentioned the kind of things that we've been doing to drive that continually across both 2018 and 2019. And I would say, in normal market conditions, there's probably more to go after there, which is great. A quick word on FX. So obviously the currency exchange markets are quite volatile at the moment. for understandable reasons. We are hedged for both 2020 and partially for 2021. And if I give you an idea of what rates we are hedged at, if you look at the current spot rates for dollar and RMB, that's pretty much the rate at which we have hedged for this year. So good, great progress on gross margin overall. Flipping over the page to overheads, slide 10, you can see a £2.2 million increase in overheads year over year. A lot of that came from sources that we couldn't really necessarily do much about. So firstly, inevitably, we experienced cost inflation. That was responsible for pretty much half of the total increase in overheads. Bonuses naturally increased as the performance of the group improved, and quite rightly so. And the share-based payment charge also increased for various reasons, which I won't bore you with, but it's just a function of the accounting around LTIP schemes. So that was really, those three items, the majority of the overhead increase that we saw. In normal years, you would have expected to see Luceco investing significantly in new sales resource to drive future growth. You can see that is there on this bar chart. It's the final bar. We did put extra sales resource into the UK professional side of the business, as well as our strongest European businesses. The difference is that in this year, and I think this will be a feature going forward as well, we basically self-funded that investment by withdrawing resource from a US business, which has proven not to be that successful. And you can see in the text, I've highlighted other markets where we are doing the same thing. So I mentioned that we've withdrawn some resource from France, and we are in the process of also withdrawing resource from our Hong Kong business. Again, the intention being to reinvest those proceeds elsewhere in the group. Okay, slide 11, segmental results. I've given you all a bit more detail here. So you'd be used to seeing our four segments, so those are unchanged. You would be used to seeing revenue and operating profit for each one. Of course, I'm sure you know, the operating profit comes after me quite arbitrarily allocating a whole bunch of central fixed costs across the segments. I think it's actually more instructive to look at what the true contribution of those business groups actually were before central costs, because that's the true profitability, and B, because it gives you an indication of what future profit the group will drive as it grows each one of those segments. So you can see a contribution margin for everyone. So hopefully that's helpful. In terms of what the story is for segmental results year over year, suffice to say, they all grew, they all contribute profit, they all improved their profitability. Unsurprisingly, wire and accessories remains the highest contributor in terms of millions and percentage. But I would draw your attention to LED. So the overall operating margin at first sight looks a little low at 2.2%. If you take away those central fixed costs, you see the contribution margin, real true contribution margin, is more like 9.4%. And then if you spread that back a little bit further, as I do in the commentary, you can see that's really a function of a really quite strong contribution from our mature UK LED business and a break-even contribution from our overseas LED business, with the latter being, at this stage, relatively immature. So in other words, as we grow our overseas business and gain scale, there's every reason to think that the overall profit of the LED segment will improve. Okay, moving on to slide 12. This was probably the best part of, the most pleasing part of the performance for us. So, very strong free cash flow, as John has mentioned, obviously born out of strong profitability. But I would also call out the contribution that was made by a very tight control of inventory. So over the last 2 years, we've reduced our inventory days from 135 down to 105. And the 30 days that we got rid of wasn't just, they weren't just any old days. They were probably the oldest, most aged, most obsolete items, the hardest to get rid of. So, I mean, I sit here feeling pretty good that we have dealt with that and generated cash along the way. So that certainly helped. CapEx was a little bit lower than we had previously guided. So if you recall, we said ordinarily this business should spend about 3-4% of its revenue on CapEx. And when I say CapEx, I mean both physical assets and R&D. 2019 came in at only 2.1. There are some good reasons for that. there wasn't a lot of need to spend money on physical assets in 2019. And our R&D activity was really focused on generating new versions of existing products, so cheaper versions of existing products, rather than new products, and so therefore less easy to capitalize that. So that all led to a free cash flow margin of double digit, 11% in the year, which was great to see. Okay, on to slide 13. So I'm about to show you that this 2019 was not the only year where the business has generated that amount of free cash flow. You probably just don't realize what we actually did in 2018. So to illustrate that, I've shown you a net debt bridge from 2017's balance sheet through until 2019. So if you look at the dark green bars there, those are the reported net debt numbers for the group. So you would be forgiven for thinking that over the last 2 years, we've reduced our net debt by 10 million, from 37 million down to 27 million. And that we've reduced our reported leverage from 2x down to 1x. And that would be a good performance. The reality is that the performance has been a lot stronger than that. And the reason is because the starting point, the starting true indebtedness was quite a lot higher than what was sitting on the balance sheet. And what I mean by that is the group made quite significant use of debt factoring. And it also, at that time, made quite a lot of use of creditor payment extension. And also, to complete the picture, of course, in 2019, I've been forced to adopt IFRS 16, which wasn't in force back in 2017. So if you normalize for all of those factors, what is really the case is that the net debt in the business is reduced from 66 million down to 32 million. And so therefore, we have generated 34 million of cash over 2 years, not 10. Nearly all of that from free cash flow. So I would say this is, in real terms, the second year in a row in which we have delivered double-digit free cash flow margin. And I think that is the kind of performance that this business is capable of in the long term. Okay, the balance sheet I'll probably not dwell on. Suffice to say that it looks pretty neat and tidy. And all the work we've done in terms of profitability and capital efficiency has generated a return on capital in excess of 20% for the first time, which is good to see. Just completing my slide then, I've got a page here which is called financial model. What I try to do here is, and you'll see this is laid out in the ARA, which is on our website today. We try to give a bit more color around a summary of the true investment case for Luceco in terms of the markets we choose to operate in, the business model that we operate, and also the financial outcomes that we expect of ourselves. And I've chosen to sort of summarize the latter here. So if you can read it, in the middle of the slide, you'll see expected outcomes. And what I'm saying is between revenue, profit, cash, CapEx, M&A, this is what I expect this business to be able to deliver. I won't go through them now. I think they make quite a compelling investment case. And I'm sure it's something that you'll want to reflect on as you project your numbers into the future. So that's everything from me for now. With that, I'll hand back to John. John, you might be on mute.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Matt. as you can see, we had a very strong result last year, and we were completely and totally confident of a significant improvement in this year, which, as we know, is not to be. But some of the other advances the business made last year, I mean, the higher margins, as Matt said, was a lot about the work we did with the product and we did at the factory, but it was also the work that we did with the mix of the customers and the mix of the products. So particularly within the lighting channel, we moved away from commodity products into higher margin, niche, kind of professional specification products. So the business that we bought in 2017, which is known as Kingfisher Lighting, only a small business, but it has a gross margin of about 45% and an operating margin of around 12%. And that is what we think we can, over time, achieve in our lighting division. As you know, we didn't have any lighting products prior to 2013. So the business is very young, and it is still subscale, particularly internationally. But I think as it grows in size and scale, the margins will improve significantly. Probably not to the levels that we can enjoy in the wiring accessory category, but certainly higher than the margins that we are enjoying now. We also expanded our range of the wiring accessories. We launched a range of smart wiring accessories that allow you to control your lights and your sockets from your phone. Historically, as Matt said, product development and range extension has been a significant driver of the growth of this business. And we will continue to move in that direction. We've got many new initiatives coming that I can run you through in a minute. But we also invested a lot in the customer service proposition to improve how we interact with our customers, be it in the warehouse, on the digital platforms. And we've made a lot of progress on these other areas, which, frankly, when the business was growing at a sort of compound average of 25%, some of these areas were overlooked. And now that we've entered a slower growth phase, we've been playing catch up with some of these activities. If you turn over the page to page 18, you can see some examples of areas where we have been extending the product range. As I mentioned, the BG Smart range has been extremely successful, and we are expanding that later on this year. Office Electrics is a totally new initiative for us. It's a surprisingly high margin category. It's also a surprisingly large value market. It's actually about the same size as wiring accessories, but it's all the same technology that we are using in the other product categories. And we'll be launching a range into the market in the second half of this year. And we have high hopes that that will be a new and successful venture. EV charging, something we launched at the beginning of this year. This is for the residential domestic market. And we have been ongoing expansion of the LED lighting range. As I said earlier, particularly in sort of higher value, more sophisticated technical specification products. The factory in China, if you turn over to page 19, has been a major focus for the group for the last 10 years. But as the volumes have grown, I think we outgrew the management which we had at the factory. So last year we employed a new senior team at the factory to really drive the efficiency levels, and so far the indications are that we can make some significant improvements here. I mean, what this is worth in terms of gross margin in the future is hard to predict, but I think there is certainly some upside. I mean, the management we had were extremely good at the startup phase, but as the factory has grown and the product range has become more mature, we've had to make some changes to really drive world class of efficiency through the factory. If you turn over the page to page 20, we've also been investing, as I said earlier, in the customer service proposition. So we had a risk that our warehouse in the UK was going to run out of space, but we've managed to invest in new warehousing systems, automatic picking, etc., which has meant that we will no longer have to move out of the UK, which is a significant saving on the future CapEx bill. We've also been investing to improve our forecasting and planning activities, which has improved our customer fill rates, and again means that we can remain operating out of the same facility. If you turn over the page, another area where we've been doing a lot of work is to improve our overall systems and processes. I mean, again, the point I made before, that when we were growing the business so strongly, we underinvested in these kind of systems and processes, including the finance function. And we saw in the end of 2017 the impact of that. But if I'm honest, you know, there were other areas of the business where the systems and the processes weren't as invested in as they should have been. So we've been playing a bit of catch up here. A transactional website for our customers so they can interact with us on a digital basis 100% will be launched in the second half of this year. Sort of CRM, ERP, and other sort of business improvement systems. Hyperion, as a financial consolidation system, has been implemented last year. The overall impact of these improvements will be incremental, but I think it does mean that any future growth will be on a much more sustainable footing than perhaps we have before. And with that, Matt, I'll hand over to you to talk about the impact of the virus.
Sure. Thank you. Right. So slide 22 then. I think John has referenced some of this already. So it feels to me, and I'm sure it does to John, like we've been involved in this virus thing before even the WHO. So we saw this right in the middle of January. We were very active with our Chinese management team at the time to prepare our factory for, you know, what might happen. I think that those preparations served us pretty well. As John said, we were forced to close our factory for a couple of weeks extra in the month of February. When we reopened, like a lot of factories, we found that our staff were kind of in the wrong parts of the country. And because of the lockdown, they weren't able to return to our factory in Jiaxing. So to give you a sense for that, on opening, we had 200 out of 800 normal line operators. And our job was then to try to increase it rapidly. And I think the Chinese management team did a fantastic job, so that by the end of March, we'd increased it from 200 up to 800, so therefore back to normal capacity again. Of course, the irony is that now that we know we have a demand reduction, we've been forced to go back down the other side of the hill. And we've taken the number of operators from 800 down to 400. but nevertheless, it did help to mitigate the demand, the supply impact at the time. In terms of demand, I would sort of break it into quarters. So the first quarter, we only saw a supply impact. It did result in our revenue being roughly 10% down on the previous year. But with gross margin improvement and cost reduction, it allowed us to keep our profit in line with budget. As we started into Q2, we began to see a demand impact. I'd say that we were pretty proactive, and we knew we saw this coming before probably a lot of people, helped by our China experience. So all of our mitigating actions were in place from the 1st of April to coincide with the reduction in activity. So activity has reduced so far this month by 50%. Because of all the cost reductions we've put in place, we've managed to achieve EBITDA break-even so far, and we've managed to limit our cash losses to only £500,000 a month. And if you compare that to our total undrawn facilities and £24 million, or £24.5 million as of the end of Q1, you can see that actually our funding position is really pretty good. We turn over to the page, to page 23, it goes into that in a bit more detail. So top left, you'll see the benefits of all the mitigating actions. These are not theoretical actions. These are now all done from the start of the month. They have chopped about 40% out of our fixed cost base. And they have converted what would have been, a really quite significant monthly cash loss into a minimal cash loss right now, which is great. Bottom left, you'll see our funding position. So plenty of headroom in our facilities with options for additional funding should we need them. But nevertheless, because none of us can foresee exactly what happens next, we have had some discussions with our relationship bank. They've been extremely supportive. I guess my plan was to, if I needed a favor, I'd rather ask for the favor now rather than wait for any downside case to materialize. So we have reset some covenants later in the year, and we have also converted some of our invoice financing into RCF just to make the debt capacity a bit more stable and predictable. So none of this has been done to accommodate a base case. It's only been done to accommodate a really quite severe downside case. And the status of these changes is they've all been agreed, they've gone through the bank's credit committee. We are just into the legal documentation phase at this point. So I think that's it. John, over to you for the wrap up.
Okay, thanks, Matt. In terms of current trading, so when the lockdown started end of March, our world completely closed. It was paralyzed. Most of our customers closed, and our sales we thought would be close to zero. But actually, it hasn't materialized like that. As the lockdown week by week has progressed, more customers have opened. The online channels have been particularly strong. I mean, Screwflix, our largest customer, their sales last week were 20% down. B&Q announced yesterday that they're opening 61 stores. All the construction sites immediately closed, and they've slowly been opening. All house building stopped, and it's slowly been coming back. So throughout the month, we have seen an improvement in the revenues, and FOB orders that had been originally pushed back to sort of at the end of the summer have been slowly pulled back. So actually, we are now forecasting April at about 50% of normal revenue. And as I said, it has been increasing throughout the month. So I think Q2 could be somewhere between 50 to 60% of normal revenues. And at that level, with our margins and with all the cost mitigation that we have taken on, we should be at least EBITDA break even, maybe EBITDA positive. What the future looks like after that for the second half of this year is, of course, very hard to predict. I would be surprised if it was worse than that. Q1 was on forecast. Q3, Q4, as I say, is anyone's guess, but I doubt it'll be worse than Q2. So we will end the year with a meaningful profit, but obviously significantly down on where we were forecasting before. It is worth pointing out, as I mentioned, our sales through the online channel. I mean, Amazon this year will be our second largest customer for the group. Their sales are up about 150%. All of our products are available on Amazon. And with everyone sitting at home, of course, the demand has been very strong. Into next year, you know, our forecast will be no more accurate than anyone's. I mean, ours is a cyclical business. It's unlikely to return to 2019 levels immediately. But, you know, we entered this year, as I say, highly confident that we could grow our business from 2019. And I think, you know, as and when this situation is behind us, you know, we would look forward to being able to grow again. So that concludes the presentation. I don't know, so we now hand over to any questions.
So we invite questions from analysts only on the call. To ask a question, dial 5* on your phone, and then I'll ask you by name to ask your question once your mic has been unmuted. So we have a question from Andrew Shepherd-Barron from Peel Hunt. Andrew, wait for your mic to be unmuted.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed. Great presentation. One question from me. You talked about office electrics and suggested that was, well, a large market, perhaps as large as another big target market. And yet, I'm not sort of clear that office electrics, and when I look on Screwfix Toolstation, I don't see a clear delineation of office electrics as a market per se. Can you talk a bit more about channels to market? Would it be through how are you going to push this?
Yeah, Andrew, it's a different route to market. It's a different customer base. So the customer base is either office fit out companies or it's sort of large end users who are refurbishing or setting up new offices. We stumbled across this via some M&A activity that we did a few years ago, where we looked at actually buying a company in this space. We then recruited a small team who we've been working with internally for the last year or so. We have actually one customer. Last year, we did about £1 million with the one customer on a range that we made in conjunction with them. But they own the tooling. We've now in the process of launching our own range. The small internal team that we have employed have excellent relationships and contacts within the industry. And as and when it grows, we will need to recruit a larger sales team. So you're absolutely right. It's not on Screwfix. People like Hegrand, who we compete with in wiring accessories, also do have a range in office electrics. But if you look at other companies like OE, which is Office Electrics Limited, I think, I mean, I can send you the details of the competitors. It's a very high margin, about a sort of 60% gross margin category and a 20% plus operating margin model. But the products are relatively straightforward. We have some innovations that we think make our range interesting, and the early feedback from the market is very strong. We are launching, or maybe we have launched, our own website for this range. So I can send that over to you when it's available. So you can see a bit more what is the kind of thing that we're doing, or and what I'm talking about. The market, we think, is worth over 200 million. And it's undersupplied. There are only three or four major competitors. And we think we can have a meaningful market share within a relatively short time. I mean, I know that all sounds maybe a little bit hubristic. I mean, I will point to the fact that we have been able to elbow our way into other markets in the past reasonably successfully on the back of excellent products made at fantastic prices out of our own Chinese manufacturing. So we have a track record of doing this, and I think this is an interesting category where I hope we can do it again.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Dan Cunliffe from Liberum, if you would like to ask a question when you hear that your mic has been unmuted.
Hey, good morning. Hi, John. Hi, Matt. A couple of quick questions from my side, please. Just in terms of the sort of debt levels, I mean, given what we're talking about, sort of the revenue trajectory, I know it's very difficult of understanding where COVID is going to end up this year. But in terms of the levers you have on free cash flow, in terms of CapEx, inventory day reductions, you just give us a color on where you think sort of, you know, the debt level may end up. I mean, is it sort of flattish, slightly up, slightly down, and sort of what do you think the main sort of levers are there? I mean, that's question number one. I'll come, sort of, I'll come back on question number two in a second.
I mean, Matt, why don't I just start and then you can finish? I mean, obviously, Dan, very much depends on what the second half looks like. We made a reasonable profit in Q1. We think we're going to be kind of break even Q2. That would imply, all other things being equal, that we will exit H1 maybe with slightly lower debt. And if the second half is back, then we will exit the year with slightly lower debt. I would like to think that, you know, we would end up with lower debt. Of course, if the second half, for whatever reason, is significantly worse than that, and we make losses, then we would obviously end up, you know, potentially with higher debt. I mean, you rightly point out that CapEx is a lever. If the business is not growing, working capital is a lever. So even, you know, with small losses, we would be able to mitigate you know, some of the movement on the debt. So I think I wouldn't expect actually significant movement either way. But Matt, I'll let you add a bit to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to say almost exactly that, John. So I mean, there's every reason to think that debt itself would be lower rather than higher at the end of the year. In extremis, I would say that you can look to what was done by the business back in 2017. So, you know, we know if we don't want to do this, but if we had a gun to our head, of course, we don't necessarily have to pay our suppliers dead on time. Back in 2017, that strategy was worth 17 million quid. So, I mean, that's always a lever. On inventory, I would say we have been pretty well ahead of the curve on this. So, you know, we very proactively chopped back on manufacturing output, as well as purchasing from OEMs. And we made that decision back in March before Boris had even thought about a lockdown. So, you know, certainly we're doing everything we can to stop inventory increasing during this period of reduced demand. And as you can imagine, there's a, as the Americans would say, a full court press on collecting cash from customers. And actually on that front, so far so good. We've not had any bad debts, and nor have we had any significant slowdown in customer payments. So that all bodes well, I think.
Okay, great. Lewis, a second question then from me, please. Just on, I think your presentation, page 15, talks quite interestingly about longer-term issues. I know COVID is a big focus right now, but longer-term would be interesting to sort of put that into context in terms of the growth. I think I've seen 5 to 10%. And also margins. I think, John, you mentioned margins in LED going to sort of 10 to 12%. So implicitly sort of suggests that wiring could be sort of slightly higher than 18% going forward. Just sort of a bit more color on the potential margins and that growth rate, 5 to 10, or I mean, obviously how much you think would be organic going forward longer term, and how much would be from M&A. Those two items would be great. Thanks.
Yeah, so not on that, Dan. I mean, we highlight, I think, on that page that we do operate in a construction space that grows faster than GDP. And historically, through, you know, customer expansion, range expansion, et cetera, international expansion, we have always grown faster than those markets. So I think there's every reason to think that organically we can grow, you know, up to the sort of 5% kind of rate through the cycle, brackets not in 2020. And I think in terms of the inorganic growth, if you look on the far right-hand side of that page, what I'm saying is, you know, if I look at my likely free cash flow, I knock off my standard dividend payout and I knock off a bit of share purchases for the EBT, I should be generating a net free cash flow of about 5% of revenue. And that ordinarily should be enough to acquire about 5% of additional revenue growth. We probably pay about 1x revenue for anyone that we buy. So if you put those two things together, you should really end up with a growth rate that would average between 5 and 10% in a normal year for this group. On the margin, I mean, wiring accessory companies worldwide generate good operating margins, as you know, so into the teens. In real terms, ours is already doing that. We don't just have wiring accessories, we have LED. LED, if we continue to focus as we are on professional grade LED products, that space also generates operating margins into the teens. So if you put the two together, there's every reason to think that the business can generate, as I've said here, between 10 and 15% operating margin, given the markets we've chosen to operate in and the model that we've chosen to deploy.
Very, very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, if
and
I can just
Chris,
add that, I mean, not a,
oh, well, sorry.
Sorry, on the, have I still got Dan? On the,
yes.
On the lighting margin question, if you benchmark sort of higher quality lighting project businesses, like, for example, FW Thorpe, so, you know, they make sort of mid-teens margins. We also have a consumer-facing lighting business, which would pull the margins down a bit. I mean, Kingfisher Lighting, in the business we bought in 2017, again, it enjoys margins of sort of 12%. So that, you know, that is achievable if you're working in the professional segment. The reason the LED margins have been low in the past is more to do with the scale of the business and the product range that we were selling. And I think as we grow and as we focus more on high margin segments within lighting, you know, we can move the margins upwards.
Okay, great. Appreciate it, Phil. Thanks very much.
And if I can just say one other thing on your earlier question, you know, as Matt said, one of the things we were very nervous about entering this kind of lockdown sort of COVID situation is that customers wouldn't pay us, that we would see smaller contractors potentially going out of business, and that would obviously impact the wholesale channel because they wouldn't be paying wholesalers, and then wholesalers in turn, particularly the smaller ones, wouldn't be paying us either because they didn't want to or they couldn't pay us because they in turn would be going out of business. So far, we haven't seen any of that. I mean, even Homebase has paid us. So We've not had a single bad debt yet as a result of this thing. Now, in the autumn, that might get a little bit worse, and that could obviously affect the net debt. I mean, not probably materially, but it is heartening to know that, you know, so far in our sector, there haven't been any major casualties.
Okay, thank you.
And now we'll go to Anne Crowe from Edison. And we're going to unmute your mic now.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the question. I've got two questions, really. The first one is there any further improvement in gross margin possible through lower cost product design? And then the second question relates to the EV chargers that you've introduced. And I was wondering whether you had got any meaningful revenue from that product category so far, what you felt the potential was, and what the competition was at the moment.
Okay, thanks. It was, sorry, I couldn't, I think the first, I couldn't hear that, was quite weak, but the first half of the question was around potential to improve gross margin at the factory, was it? Sorry.
Yeah, but gross, Not through manufacturing efficiency, but through lower cost product design. What, if there's any further potential for that?
Yeah, I mean, there's an ongoing activity to value engineer all of our products, particularly in the lighting space, as the technology improves and the LEDs improves and the understanding of drivers. And, I mean, a lot of work has been done. And we saved approximately £4 million on the cost of sales of products that we re-engineered in 2018-2019. So I would say that most of the low-hanging fruit, I'm afraid, has already been taken. That isn't to say, you know, there isn't more to come, but it's not going to have the big impact on gross margin that we had 2018-2019. In terms of EV charging, we have we had any meaningful revenue? We only launched it in Q1 of this year, which obviously didn't. I think all vehicle sales, electric or otherwise, have fallen through the floor. So that whole sort of market obviously is very abnormal currently. We were targeting mainly our house builder customers, and there is some possible regulation which is under consideration at the moment in Parliament, which will mean if it goes through that every new dwelling has to have an EV charger built into it. Every new house in the garage will need an EV charger. Now, if that was to happen, the potential market for us on 300,000 new homes, and these things, they will sell for about £200-250, the potential new market only in the new house building sector is large. If we were to get our market share of EV in new house building in line with our market share of wiring accessories and circuit protection in new house building, that would imply revenue of around 20 to 30 million on EV charging. The government, however, haven't finalized whether that regulation will happen. So at the moment, you know, that would be a hope rather than a forecast.
That's really helpful, thank you. And is there significant competition at the moment?
In EV charging? Yes, there is. Companies like Rolec, but we do have strong relationships with house builders because we supply lots of wiring accessories, circuit protection, and LED lighting into house builders. And we would have stronger relationships with house builders than our competitors in EV charging, who wouldn't have any relationship at all, I guess. So if the regulation was to be passed, I think we would be in a strong place to have an advantage over those competitors.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
And we'll now go to Christian Hinderaker from Liberum. We are unmuting your mic now, Christian.
Yes, good morning, John and Matt. Thank you for taking my questions. Just two from me quickly. I guess firstly, perhaps if you could comment on trends in portable power, which perhaps didn't get as much daylight as the other two main divisions in terms of revenues and margins, and sort of how you see those progressing, both perhaps through the year and more medium term. And then secondly, on page 10 of your presentation, you sort of cite some divestment in, of your Hong Kong sales office, and just trying to gauge what your sort of strategy is with respect to internationalisation of, I suppose, LED to start with, and then perhaps wiring accessories on a medium-term view.
Sure. Shall I just quickly talk about Hong Kong, and then I'll let Matt answer the. So, in the out of our Hong Kong office, we were targeting international retailers who had buying offices in the Far East, and most large retail national chains or international chains have buying offices either at Hong Kong, maybe Shenzhen, Guangzhou, or Shanghai. We opened the office there, I think, about 3 years ago. We transferred the guy who was running the US business over to Hong Kong. And we decided, frankly, that we could do this out of the offices that we have in the mainland of China. So we've kept one of the sales guys. We've closed the office. We have transferred all the customers over to our sales function that we have at our Jiaxing factory, which is just outside of Shanghai. Actually, the largest customers we were dealing with are actually based in Shanghai anyway. They're not even based in Hong Kong. So we just got to the point where we thought the Hong Kong overhead was not an overhead that we needed to have in order to service those customers. So we haven't given up on the customers. We haven't given up on the international growth of the retail channel. It's mainly retailers, but we've just decided that we don't need the overhead of a Hong Kong office. So it's, you know, not a big move strategically. And sorry, Christian, what was your other question?
Yeah, just on portable power in terms of growth and margin trends.
It's difficult. I have been forecasting the commoditization of the master plug range for a long time. It's a consumer product. It's increasingly sold through the online channel. The threat is that when you own the space in B&Q, you go into B&Q, you can only buy a master plug product because that's the product on the shelf. And it's the only product on the shelf. Yet when you go onto Amazon, you can buy hundreds of cable reels from hundreds of sort of no brand manufacturers, some of questionable quality. So there's no doubt that the advance of the online channel is not helpful for the portable power category. Having said that, you know, last year it grew and the margins were stable, or they grew a bit. So, you know, the forecast of the commoditization has been pushed back by another year or so. But I do think in the long run, it's not an area of the business where we will be able to make sustainable higher margins. It's mainly sold on an FOB basis. So from a working capital point of view, it's highly efficient. We don't make it in our own factory. We make it at a third party. And we do have a very high market share and a strong market position, particularly in the UK market. But over time, I'm afraid I think it won't command the same sort of margin levels that it does now. But as I said, I've been forecasting that for some time and I've been wrong. So let's hope I continue to be wrong.
Great. Thanks, John.
So we have no more questions. So John and Matt, thank you very much indeed. This is the end of the conference call.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.